I continue to get questions about my occasional use of the NIV and the missing words that appear in one version or another. Someone pointed out in an email that there are 1,000 verses that are missing from the New International Version that are in the King James Version. Oh, I'm sorry. 1,000 words, he said, not verses. Now, let's play a little thought experiment here. Let's imagine for a moment you know Greek and English well enough to do a translation of a Greek document. Your problem is, as you sit down to work, you have two different Greek manuscripts of the same document, and they vary in small ways. It's an interesting thing about these old documents of the Greek New Testament is that the variances that are in them are insignificant compared to the number of ways they are exactly alike. They are so alike that it's astonishing, in fact. But anyway, as you prepare to start, you have a decision to make. For whom are you doing this translation? Now, why would that be important? Because after all, aren't you just wanting to bring it through? Well, it has to do with two different methods of rendering a new version. Very different methods. One is called formal equivalence. Formal equivalence is a word-for-word rendering of the text. Somewhat like what you see in the translation below the Greek in a Greek-English interlinear New Testament. Now, naturally, that's going to result in an English text that is very hard to read. There is, and have been over time, one or two literal translations. Seems to me there's a Young's literal New Translation, but frankly, they're not really a lot of help. Among modern translations, the New American Standard Bible tries to lean in the formal direction more than some of them do, and it doesn't read quite as well as a result of it. Now, the other method of translation is called dynamic equivalence. Dynamic equivalence tries to express the thought, the intent, and the meaning of the original text in the language of the day in which you're doing the translation. In other words, what I'm trying to do, since the New Testament was written in vernacular Greek, what I want to do is I want to bring the New Testament forward into vernacular English, the kind of English that anybody would understand. That should be a good way of doing it. Now, believe it or not, the King James Version was closer to dynamic than it was to the formal. They gave a nod in the direction of the formal by putting the words that were not in the original manuscripts in italics. And this sometimes, you know, puzzles people. They're reading along in the King James and they see italics. What does that mean? It means it was not in the original. It was supplied because it was understood as a result of what the Greek was saying. But King James English was the English of England in the 17th century. It was the vernacular. Here's the problem with the King James Version. Languages evolve. If you live long enough, you may actually notice this yourself. You may have seen some examples in the founding documents of our own country. The handwriting is so very different, as is the grammatical construction. And the differences that you note arose within a period of a mere 300 years, not 2,000, in that short period of time. And if you go back much further than that, you look at a case of English handwriting, you can't read it at all. But the differences are going on around you all the time, imperceptibly. I began to notice, for example, a developing generational accent in this country. For the longest period of time, we all sort of recognized people by their regional accent. There was a southern accent, general. There was a southwestern and a southeastern southern accent. There was a northern accent. There was a Chicago accent. There was a Maine accent. Well, through television, that's all beginning to change as the different accents around the country tend to devolve back toward television. But what's also going on at the same time is the young generation now, the 20-somethings and so forth, are beginning to speak ever so slightly different from older people. Listen for it. Perhaps you will begin to notice it as I have. Now, electronic media, as I said, are erasing regional accents, but they're being replaced by generational accents, the way vowels are formed and emphasis is delivered. Now, when I first noticed this in young people, I thought it was an affectation, but as time went on, I concluded, no, this is an accent in the process of development, And it's just like if I sat down with William Shakespeare and tried to have a talk with him, I probably would not be able to understand a word he was saying. When I lived in England, I remember I was sitting down with a chap in Birmingham one night, and we were talking about the difficulty in understanding the British accent and the American accent. He said, there's nothing unusual about it. He said, I have trouble understanding people in a village. He named the village about 40 miles down the road from him in the Midlands. I have trouble understanding people who live in that village to this day. So, you know, it's nothing particularly unusual about this type of thing. Languages, spoken and written, evolve. Now, what all this means is that if you sit down to do a translation today, it will come out somewhat differently from a version done, say, 400 years ago into English. And it should. One is not better than the other if they both speak faithfully to their own generations. So as you begin your translations, you look down at the two manuscripts you have before you. And as you come to variables in the original, you have a decision to make. If you're doing a dynamic equivalence translation, you have very little problem with this, because the variances rarely change the meaning of the text. I used to hear a lot about the so-called errors in the different versions, the different Greek manuscripts. I began to look into it more deeply. And when you begin to understand what Greek is all about, what you will simply see is in some cases it may be a misspelled word. It may be a change in the case, because words are spelled differently in Greek if they are a direct object of a sentence instead of the subject of the sentence. And in some cases, it's just a question of which is this supposed to be. So if you're a translator and you really understand your languages, this does not pose much of a problem for you at all. All you do is you ask yourself, what is the author trying to say? What did he mean? And I've got to render it into language that you can sit down and read and understand. And hopefully try to get it to come through to you with the same feeling that a Greek reader of the first century would have had when he did it. Now, you need to understand that the languages of the Bible are not themselves holy. Hebrew and Greek are evolved and evolving languages. If you render the Greek into the language of an older English generation, you aren't being true to your reader. Now, I still love the King James Version, although I paraphrase it all the time, because I grew up with it. If I recall a scripture that I want to look up, I have to use a King James concordance to find it, because that's the way I recall the scripture. I had no alternatives as I was growing up. I'm not sure that there would have been another version of the Bible in Arkansas besides the King James Version. I'm joking. I'm sure there was one somewhere. But I am increasingly today beginning to use the New International Version, not because I prefer it, but because the people who hear me prefer it. The whole idea is to try to make the Bible more accessible to people. But what if, in doing your translation, you encounter a variance in the two manuscripts that does affect the meaning? Well, what do you do about that? You know, your problem, I'm sorry to say, is bigger than that. You have not two, but over 5,300 Greek manuscripts to deal with. They are all handwritten. Now, consider the implications of that, and let's do another thought exercise. Imagine you're in Jerusalem and you see Mark the Evangelist every week. He's just as common as any friend of yours might be. One week you learn that Mark has finally decided it's advisable to write down his gospel. Now, maybe you're in Rome, as a matter of fact, since that seems to be where Mark might have been. Okay, what Mark sits down and writes in his own hand is called the autograph, the original. Would you like to have a copy of it of your own? Oh, sure, I'd love to. I got to have a copy. What do you mean? Well, how would you get it? Well, there are several ways. One, you can sit down with the original copy and copy it out in your own handwriting. Now, there's an interesting side note here you might be interested in, a word called epigraphy. It's basically the study of handwriting. And I was amazed at it when I learned this, but it's a relatively new science that has developed in biblical studies, actually not just biblical studies, but all of the ancient writings that are out there. that these guys who have studied this year after year after year and have compared documents where they absolutely know when it was written by hand. And I was told by a scholar who ought to know that epigraphers can now take a handwritten manuscript and they can date it within 10 years of the time the guy sat down to write it. Because the style of making letters, the style of handwriting, all that stuff changes over time. It does today, just like it did then. In fact, sometimes I'm wondering if anybody's still studying handwriting, if they still sit around in school and make letters from the letters on the blackboard like we had to do. Well, anyway, we're going to copy out our own copy. Will you make any mistakes? Well, almost certainly you would. You might, for example, leave out a word. Since you were there, also, when one of the events Mark describes took place, you just might make a marginal note of your own on your manuscript. After all, it's my copy. In fact, if you picked up one of my old Bibles and looked at them, you'll find more marginal notes all over the place in there because I didn't want to forget something that I wrote there. Now, punctuation is a later invention, so when you're writing all this stuff in Greek at the time, all your words run together without any spaces between them in most cases, and they all square up on both sides of the manuscript. They're just a bunch of letters on the page, really hard to read. In one place, in the course of copying this thing out, you actually left out a line that we're doing again, our thought experiment, because the closing word of one line was repeated in the next line. Easy mistake to make. In fact, you probably have done this sometime if you did much copying. Now, is your copy worthless because you did it that way? Well, no. Is it unreliable? Well, hardly. The story is there, after all. But here's the joker. Every manuscript that is made from your manuscript, and you do know this will happen, don't you? You got in a boat, you left Rome, you went down to Alexandria, which is where your home was. And everybody in Alexandria, as soon as they found out you had a copy of Mark's Gospel, wanted one. So they'll start copying them out themselves from yours. They will certainly include your errors, and they may even include your marginal notes. A lot of the scholars call this a gloss. Something is put in to add additional meaning to it. There's one particular verse, I think, in Book of Acts, where there is a section of a verse that is left out, and I'm almost certain that it was put in there as a marginal note by someone along the way who knew what the reason was why Paul did something, and just said, yes, that was because he wanted to be at Jerusalem for Pentecost. But it wasn't in the original that Luke wrote. But it made its way in, possibly from somebody's marginal notes. Now let's continue the thought experiment. How many copies of your manuscript would you imagine might be made in the first year? Now remember, hand copying is the only way to reproduce anything. Didn't have any Xerox machines, did at all. How valuable would a manuscript of Mark's Gospel be to any first century church? Oh, you couldn't even begin to think about the value of it. But every copy that is made of your manuscript will have your errors in it and maybe your marginal notes. What this then does, it creates a family of manuscripts, and they are recognizable to scholars. Down through the period of time since then, of 2,000 years of scholarship, all these ancient manuscripts have been sorted and sorted and resorted, and finally they begin to figure out where the families of manuscripts are. Since you were a Jewish merchant, your business moved you to Alexandria, they'd call the family of your manuscript Alexandrian. Now, another way manuscripts were created is that one man would read it and other people would write it down. Now, you don't have to guess at this. Pretty soon, there are going to be some misspelled words in some of those documents because you're not looking at the word you're writing down. And a lot of words do sound the same when they aren't quite the same word. And we commonly do not hear what is actually said. We hear what we expected to hear. Or perhaps the speaker can unconsciously paraphrase. If you ever want to hear a good example of that, just listen to me reading the King James Version, because I do it all the time. I paraphrase it, and I don't even realize that I'm doing it. It's automatic. So, grammatical errors can creep in. And what also happens is corrections of grammar in the original creep in. This is why two scholars, you may wonder about this, having two manuscripts in hand, one of them has a grammatical error and the other has that passage correct grammatically. Which one do you think the scholars will tend to think is correct? Well, they come down on the side of the manuscript with the grammatical error. The reason is that a copyist is more likely to be tempted to correct an error than to introduce one. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but if you know enough and you have the time to fool with it, you can decide for yourself which way it should be. New Testament textual critics have sorted the witnesses into three major groups called text types. The most common division today is this way. The Alexandrian text type constitutes a group of early and well-regarded texts, Codex Vaticanus, Codex Sinaiticus. The Western text type is also very early. By Western, we mean Roman in Europe. The Western type is also very early, but its witnesses are seen to be more prone to paraphrase and other corruptions. The Byzantine text type is a group of around 95% of all manuscripts, the majority of which are comparatively late in the tradition. Now, you would think, you know, that the majority would rule. You know, you got more manuscripts that say this and fewer that do it the other way. But it isn't exactly that way. You don't really need to know all this, but it serves as background to answer questions of reliability. In my opinion, the scholars have done an excellent job working through the various texts available to them, and what they are working with is completely reliable as to the meaning of the Bible. Not only that, but most Bibles will have marginal notes as to the choices of text that they use. The King James Version is based on what they call the Textus Receptus, or received text. It's a text that is more than adequate for telling the Bible story. One of the best things about all this is it is proof positive that no authority ever had the New Testament under their absolute control. This is really important because I've heard people make the argument, well, the Roman Catholic Church actually changed the New Testament at some point in history. They didn't. They couldn't. For one thing, during all the main development time, there was no such thing as a Roman Catholic Church. But in course of time, the Bible developed all over the Middle East simultaneously. The books originated all over the empire. They were scattered to the four winds. And while one scholar who's going through all this stuff may be biased, another is not, and he will make his reputation on cutting the rugs out from under that scholar who is biased. They all know their work will be challenged again and again, and it has been. One should know this, though, about the conventional wisdom of scholars on this one point. They tend to dismiss the Byzantine copies because they are later. You know, I commented that they're 95% of all the copies we have are of the Byzantine type. But what you should know is the Byzantine copies were made under much stricter supervision and with more method than was sometimes found elsewhere. Also, old manuscripts were burned. They weren't kept around to gather mold. It was systematic. So consequently, even though what you're reading in a Byzantine text is later, that doesn't mean it's unreliable. The fact is, they were much more careful in their procedure of copying manuscripts than somebody down in Alexandria might have been. And they heavily influenced the text from which the King James Version was taken. Now, if the text concerns you, in other words, if you don't like the NIV or the Revised Standard Version because they played games with the text, in fact, the last several verses of Mark are missing in the text that these translations use. If that bothers you, but yet at the same time you don't want to have to struggle with the King James Version, you can use the New King James Version, which is actually translated out of the same text as the Old King James Version with very little modification of that. It's just a whole lot easier to read. I don't use it very much, certainly in print, because Thomas Nelson, who owns a copyright to it, are a little persnickety about how you're supposed to do it. But for your reading and your purposes, the New King James Version will serve you just fine. Okay, that's it for today. Tune in next week, and we'll continue to walk along with Mark and listen to his story. I'll see you then.